Not in this world, they won't. They won't come to learn, they'll come to stare. Lazarus the second. 50 cents to look, a dollar to touch.
Coming to you from the Cinema Lounge of the Carolina Asheville, it's Elitist Bastards Go to the Movies, featuring Ken Hanke.
Hi there.
And Justin Souther.
Hi.
I'm your producer, Gladys. Steve Shanafelds.
So let's start off with, Ken, you saw an unusual documentary this week, Black Power Mixtape.
1967 through 75, yes.
And tell me a little bit about what that is.
Black Power Mixtape is an odd film in that it is... They've taken essentially 9 years' worth of TV footage from Swedish television and edited it, this must have been a monumental task in itself, into a 9-chapter picture of those years. And they're all from things that were done for Swedish TV covering the Black Power movement during that period of time. And they're very different from the things that I remember seeing, because we were never allowed to. American television, as I remember, and now bear in mind, I was 21 when this thing was finished. So there's a lot of this is a little hazy to me. But I don't remember ever being allowed to see Angela Davis actually speak. I don't remember ever being allowed to see Stokely Carmichael when he wasn't on a podium, or Eldridge Cleaver, or any of these people. I never got to see them as articulate human beings. I got to see them as people who were ranting. And in Angela Davis's case, I don't remember getting to see much of anything at all, except that attempt to railroad her into the gas chamber in California, thank you, Governor Reagan, which they fortunately did not manage to do. So it gives it a very different perspective. Now, is it an anti-American perspective? That is an interesting question, and it came up at the time that the film was being shot, because Nixon's buddy, the uber right-wing publisher of TV Guide, did something really unusual in that he actually wrote an article for TV Guide, which is not an article for their readership, for God's sake, about how Swedish television was anti-American. And interestingly, rather than just refute this or go on the defensive about it, these same TV journalists just went and interviewed him and got his side of the story as to why he thought it was anti-American.
Does the film address at all why the Swedes were interested in this topic? I mean, you know...
No, it's very unclear as to why the Swedes were particularly taken with this, but they were, and they did a much better job of documenting it than anything I saw that we did, which is kind of sad. But sometimes an outside perspective is not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't attempt to be comprehensive. It's a snapshot. It's a snapshot of each year. And of course, some years have more happen than others. I mean, one of the years was like there and gone before you realize that anything had happened. And of course, it has a typical documentary problem of it goes on too long. And part of the reason it goes on too long is by 1975, the Black Power movement ain't nothing to get excited about, and it's become a rather dreary topic by this time, because so much of it has been eroded, so much of it has just gone completely. These people are in exile, these people are in jail, the whole conspiracy, all that's got to work on at that point is the whole conspiracy of whether or not the government themselves used drugs in the ghettos the way they once used horse blankets that had smallpox germs in them. And there's really nowhere to go with that, aside from which it's just a real downer to end on. But I mean, overall I found it fascinating.
Do you recommend it for a sort of general audience?
I recommend it to an audience who isn't going to go ballistic over it, because there's a certain group of people, I could even tell you the ones that on the Mountain Express website that will post about it, who are just going to go apeshit over this thing that, you know, oh, it's a bunch of anti-American lies, and, you know, I was in Vietnam, and all the rest of this stuff. And I just, you know, I don't think that they will get any good out of the film. I think you have to approach it with a kind of an open mind to the degree that you can on a really inflammatory topic. You can't just go into this, you know, already against it. You're not going to be swayed.
The next film that we should talk about is about as far removed from that sort of controversy as I can think of. Although it does have a certain level of controversy. It's a spin-off of Shrek. Shrek 2.
Yes, it's a spin-off from Shrek 2.
This is Puss in Boots, of course.
Puss in Boots, yes.
What's it about?
It's about 90 minutes long.
And Puss in Boots?
It's an origin story of Puss in Boots. The comic book film has so much to answer for. This is all we needed was an origin story for Puss in Boots.
Does he start off with boots on?
No.
Then it's really not an origin story.
No.
Unless they're going to show him getting his boots.
They do.
Oh, okay. Wait, do they follow the traditional, I can't remember who wrote the children's story, but the
is there one?
Yeah, there's a children. The story is that, like, the third son or whatever inherits the only thing from his father, and it's a cat.
Oh, no. He gets them because he does something heroic.
Oh, okay.
He's an orphan. He doesn't have a father. Well, I presume he does, but he doesn't have one that he knows. It's the problem with this movie, other than the fact that several days later I can remember almost nothing about it, is it's too late. I mean, it's going to do fine. It opened strong. I mean, it did the, you know, it ran over the rest of the box office this weekend. Of course, part of that's 3D charges, but when Shrek 2 came out, Shrek 2 managed to be even better than Shrek. And it seemed fresh, and it seemed funny, and it was all very new. 6 years after that, this ain't new. And, you know, we've been waiting. I mean, they announced this spinoff within days of Shrek 2 opening, and now we finally get it. And it's fine. I didn't mind sitting through it. I had no trouble sitting through it. I think I actually laughed loudly twice, and one of them...
Did you guffaw?
I did not guffaw, but I did at least chortle.
Did you LOL?
Don't ever accuse me of that. But I there were two solid laughs. One of them was a gag that Ricardo Montalban had already used, and he really has the rights to it in Spy Kids 3. But it's what Puss in Boots are made out of.
Okay.
And the other one, though, the funny thing is, and it was easily the funniest thing in the movie, it was my viewing companion, Brian, it was the one thing that he laughed out loud about. And that is a gag taken from a gag from the ending credits of Shrek 2. It just has had a line of dialogue added to it. And the line of dialogue, I'll admit, is pretty funny. But it's just, you know, it's just, it's fine. It's entertaining. If you were a small child, you would probably LOL. If you are an adult, you'll probably just not mind sitting through it. If you have to take a small child, God knows there are worse things you could have to do.
But small children roll in their seat.
I don't know about that.
They roll around in their
seats. I've never actually seen them do that, except in letters to the editor bitching about your review.
Yeah. Speaking of your reviews, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about a film that you reviewed.
Which one?
Out of all the films you reviewed this week, what's your favorite? We'll talk about that one.
That would be In Time, since that's the only movie I reviewed this week.
So you're going to talk about it in time, or you're going to talk about it now?
Now.
Oh, okay.
And for clarity purposes, it's not that you couldn't have reviewed other films. You were helping Mountain Express team out with Mokefest.
Well, it was that, and there wasn't really a ton of stuff out this weekend. I'm sure Ken would have stuck another movie on me, given the chance.
Puss in Boots,
right,
would have been yours.
Or Anonymous.
But Anonymous did not come into town,
I know.
And I'm afraid it never will.
That's a shame, really.
It is.
It's really actually kind of sad. Anyway, I saw In Time.
And from what I've read about this film, it's... I mean, it's basically about a future where time has been made into a commodity and everybody right. lives at age 25 and
For reasons they never really explain, and you, I guess you can read in between the lines that people have figured out how to make others immortal, but at the same time they figured out how to make it so everyone could sort of almost be immortal, but at the same time screw them over. The idea is that we've been
libertarianism.
Right. Okay. We've been genetically engineered to where we stop aging at 25. And then at 25, we have a year to live.
What happens to the people who are already past 25?
They don't worry about semantics here, Ken. So once you get to 25, you stop aging. This little green clock on your arm starts ticking. And you only have a year to live. And basically, time has become a commodity.
Well, how do you earn credits?
Work. Justin Timberlake's character works in a factory.
But of course, they pay you shit wages so that you... Yeah, okay.
Or you can borrow people's time by grabbing their hand. You can gamble your time.
Did they pull his finger or anything like that?
You can gamble your time by arm wrestling, sort of. So the idea is that there's the rich people in the world have all the time. The poor people live day to day. And really this concept is kind of nightmarish that any day could literally be your last day if you're a little too slow or anything happens to you. Unfortunately, the film never really touches on that aspect of how frightening a world this would be. It does do a pretty good job of like building a universe around how society would work under these means. But at the same time, its message about inequality, while it is like financial inequality, it's pertinent right now with all the Occupy protests and stuff. But at the same time, it doesn't feel that... It's not very illuminating. Like, it's like... If you're in tune with what it's saying, you're going to be like, yeah, duh. If you're not, it's probably going to piss you off as pinko commie leftist bullshit. So
the premise is basically that Justin Timberlake is a factory worker and
right.
through a series of things.
Yeah. Yeah, he meets a guy in a bar who's just giving away. He's giving away time.
I'm sure he
is. And really, it turns out that he's 106 years old and suicidal. He's just ready. He's done. Justin Timberlake sort of saves his life on accident, and he ends up getting all of this guy's time. So he goes to where the rich people are, and then it sort of spirals from there. He becomes a time thief, sort of.
A time bandit,
yes,
as it were.
Yes. No dwarves, though. But thankfully, Connery.
And no Ralph Richardson as God? Oh, well.
And so, I mean... The film mostly works. The idea that everybody's 25, I mean, Cillian Murphy does not look 25. But, I mean, most of these people don't look 25. But
most of these people aren't 25.
Well, and as far as the performances go, I mean, with Justin Timberlake,
he's good. I mean, everybody's good in it, but...
Including the bug-eyed girl?
Yeah, she's fine.
Is the Amanda Seyfried you're talking
about? Yeah.
Nobody bothered me.
She's a shrimp.
Would you recommend people see it?
If they're a science fiction fan, it's probably worth their while, but...
Something about it just kind of sounds, and maybe it's the stills look.
Uh-huh.
It looks kind of like the anti-Atlas Shrugged.
To an extent, I think that's fair.
Basis alone, I would say go see it.
I don't think it's quite high concept enough to be truly, really, really good. It's just sort of as middle ground as you can make the material is what it does. So,
another film that was seen this week, I don't have a good transition for it, is, although it is, it's a star-studded cast, talking about Margin Call.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about Margin Call.
Well, Margin Call is a film... that is essentially depicting the day that the first banking brokerage firm, big finance company, realized that it was all going to go to hell and that they owned all these worthless mortgages that they were never going to be able to get anything out of. And they did the only thing that seemed reasonable to them, which was to sell them all, even if it was 65 cents on the dollar in some cases, just to get rid of them, which of course is what caused the big crash. Because the minute one firm did it, everybody else realized it. And it's presented in fictionalized form as starting off with those nice people that they hire to come in and fire you and escort you from the building, since they won't do it themselves, descend on this firm, and one of the people that they off is 19-year veteran Stanley Tucci, who is working on something and he wants to finish it, and they won't let him finish it, but he has it on a flash drive, and he takes it with him, which I'm amazed that he got to do that, but I think they weren't looking, and flash drives being rather small. They get, you know, his cell phone is immediately cut off, that line to that computer is immediately cut, everything is just dead to him. And on the way out, he runs into two younger, read cheaper, employees who are in his same risk management department, and he slips the hard drive, the flash drive, to one of them, Zachary Quinto, and says, "Be careful." And this intrigues him enough that he goes, that Quinto goes and stays after hours and makes the discovery of what's about to happen, or what has actually been happening and no one has noticed yet. And this just works its way on up from him to his immediate boss, and from him to who is Paul Bettany, and from Paul Bettany to his boss, who is Kevin Spacey, and all the way up to the big mojo himself, who is Jeremy Irons, who is doing his best Jeremy Irons in this. I mean, he is just perfect for someone who, you know, is this multi-billionaire who has no idea how any of this is actually working, and in fact tells Zachary Quinto, "Speak to me as you would a small child or a golden retriever."
In your review, you mentioned that you had some concerns about the cast being so top-heavy. And in this case, it doesn't seem like that was a problem at all.
No, everybody is given something good to do. And I'm going to go on record here. Demi Moore is good in this film, which is, like, close to unthinkable to me. I mean, and she is given something worthwhile to do. There is, and Kevin Spacey is somebody who is not one of my favorite actors. And he's immensely enjoyable in this. Everybody is entertaining. Everybody is enjoyable. And these people actually are... The film is strangely... I mean, these people, these are not nice people, face it. I mean, you know, what they're doing to the rest of us and what they did was essentially criminal. But the film does manage to generate a little sympathy for them, which is remarkable, especially because there was a film earlier, it was actually in the last year, which was called The Company Men, which actually tried to make people who had been made redundant sympathetic, and they couldn't do it. But then again, they were trying to make me sympathetic because Ben Affleck had to give up his Porsche. You know, and there's nothing like that in this. I mean, this is really a solid film.
And that brings us to the last film that you reviewed this week, which is a film that you had some high hopes for, and it doesn't sound like it quite delivered on those hopes. I'm talking about The Rum Diary, latest Johnny Depp film.
Which I think we should have a contest to see how many different fake porno titles you can make out of that. We should have a contest in the comment section of the Express.
Yes, there you go.
See how long it takes it to get shut down.
So the Rum Diary is based on one of Hunter S. Thompson's first novels. It was a novel
Even
that was
though
not
it's one of his published last. But
exactly.
Yes.
It was published in 99, 98, something like
Somewhere
that.
Somewhere in that, yeah.
But it was actually written back in the 60s, and it was
yeah,
rejected.
Well, it was a book that was found when they were going through his desk, and Johnny Depp is the person who got him to publish it. And I think that part of the problem, the film is not bad. I mean, I enjoyed the film. I enjoyed many things about the film. I will have to say that although he is well preserved, I am not buying Johnny Depp as being in his 20s anymore. It just is not happening.
Is he supposed to be in this?
Yeah, he's supposed to be, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, age of 1960. And that's really hard to... I'm not, like some people have been, creeped out by the fact that he's romancing Amber Heard. That doesn't bother me. But the fact that I'm supposed to believe he's that young is a little bit of a stretch. But you have to understand, first of all, that the novel is basically presenting Hunter S. Thompson as this character. And the film goes with that. In fact, there's in one of those What Happened Next credits at the end of the film, they actually just mix and match the names Paul Kemp and Hunter S. Thompson without any regard for, you know, the fact that they're supposed to be two different people. And the thing is the book is what I would call autobiographical wish fulfillment. Hunter S. Thompson never got this job with this newspaper. He worked on some sort of sports paper in Puerto Rico briefly, but he never worked for the San Juan Star. He never was in a position to even attempt to be the crusading journalist he attempts to be as this character. So it's the whole thing, which you're going to be reading it as fact because of the way the film goes with it, is in the furthest thing from fact. It's all pretty much fiction. I mean, it's pretty good fiction. There's not a lot of story to it, though. I mean, it's basically a situation. And it's entertaining. Sometimes it's enlightening. You can see where it's trying to go, but it doesn't ever seem to quite get there. One of the big things is you know, Depp went to Bruce Robinson, who had made With Nolan and I, which is a story of an alcoholic, so this seemed like a good idea. And then he'd made How to Get Ahead in Advertising, another film that Depp admired, and so do I. And then he made Jennifer 8 in this country, which the studio took away from him and recut and changed so drastically that he became so disgusted with the film industry that he has not made a film since 1992. And Depp talked him into doing this one because he thought that he would have the touch for the characters, and in some ways he does, but he has a better touch for the supporting characters than he does Hunter S. Thompson. The big difference being, I think, that when he was doing it with Withnall and I, it was from his own life. I mean, Withnall is the man he roomed with, and the character of And I, it is so clearly, if you know what Bruce Robinson looks like, if you've seen The Music Lovers, for example, you know that Paul McGann is supposed to be Bruce Robinson. There's nobody else he could be. And The Music Lovers is right from the time period that this film takes, that With Nolan and I takes place. So it was an insider view. And this is not an insider view. This is more like an outsider view with insider input from Johnny Depp. And it just doesn't quite work. But it's not a bad film, and I did enjoy it. And I think I will actually like it more the further away I get from it. I like it more today than I did on Friday when I came out, for example. So, you know, I would recommend the film. It's just not quite a great film.
And that brings us to the special screenings for this week. Let's start with the Thursday Horror Picture Show, since that's coming up soon.
Yeah,
day after tomorrow, or
yeah,
tomorrow, right. Depending on when you hear that. It's going to be in the Cinema Lounge at the Carolina Asheville, where we are currently recording this at 8 o'clock. Get here early, because
with
it does...
Chapter 5 of Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars at 7:40, so you want to be here for that if you want to see what, you know, if you want to see how Flash got out of what he was in last week, if you were here.
Assuming Ken remembers to bring it.
Yeah, there is that. That did pose a problem a couple weeks ago. Yeah. But
we can't promise that.
No, but we'll try. But we will definitely have the Boris Karloff double feature of The Man They Could Not Hang and The Boogeyman Will Get You, which are, that's both ends of his Mad Doctor series. That's the first one and the last one. And the Mad Doctor series was this little group of films that he made for Columbia in between 1939 and 1942. And as mad doctors go, his aren't that unhinged. And most of what they're doing usually at least makes sense. They're not like Lugosi's mad doctors who are trying to turn themselves into an ape or that bizarre thing where people are transplanting apes' brains into humans and vice versa, which never seem to have a whole lot of practical medical application. But
it's fun.
Well, yeah, sure.
We're going to transplant a gorilla's lungs.
Yes, that would be good, actually.
Old gorilla lungs, hanky.
You know, the films are... The Man Who Could Not Hang is entertaining, it's fast-paced, and it is horror film with elements of a mystery novel that had been grafted onto the last section of it. The other one is a comedy mystery that is more comedy, or a comedy horror film that is more comedy than horror, and it's also directed by Lou Landers, who is one of the most style-free directors on the face of the earth, or he was while he was on the face of the earth. I think he's under it now. And it's entertaining for the byplay of Karloff and Lorre, but it's by no means a great film. It's not even what I would call a very good film. It's only marginally what I'd call a good film.
But it is a film.
This is undeniable.
It's a moving picture?
It is a moving picture, yes.
That's impressive.
You know, it's a nice 2 hours worth of entertainment, though, when you put the two films together.
And then on Tuesday of next week, same location, Cinema Lounge, Caroline Asheville.
Same time, different day.
You're screening Make Way for Tomorrow, which is a film that I had not heard of until today. And I suspect that's true for a lot of our listeners. Tell me about it.
Make Way for Tomorrow is a film that came out in 1937. That was the same year that its director, Leo McCarey, won the Academy Award for directing The Awful Truth. And when he got up to make his acceptance speech at the Oscar ceremonies, which at that time was more like a party, he thanked them and said they had given it to him for the wrong movie. And that's probably true. This is probably the most heartbreaking film you will ever watch. It is, you know, Orson Welles said it could make a stone cry. It's been called the saddest movie ever made. And it's about old age. And it's about a couple who, partly through their own fault, and I think this is part of what makes the film good, is that these people are not blameless and they are not saintly. They are troublesome, quarrelsome, and they had something to do with their own downfall. But the thing is, they're losing their house. And they have these children. And none of them want to take both of them, so they get split up. And this just gets worse. And yet they keep, it's like he keeps trying to get a job, and no one's going to hire him. And finally, they get separated by the entire continent. And which is, you know, how it's going to end. But I mean, there is no way of conveying. Bring a handkerchief. There's no way that you're going to get through this completely unmoved. And if you do, there's something seriously wrong with you.
Have you seen it?
No.
Are you planning on bringing a handkerchief?
I've got all the hanky I need.
I knew I wasn't going to get out of this. I knew it was coming. It had to. You know, in my review, I originally said bring Kleenex, and I thought, no, people are going to really take that wrong. You know, like we're showing deep throat.
And that brings us to the week's upcoming films. Of course, Black Power Mixtape, Margin Call, both them out. But there are two other films that are going to be released this week. What are they?
Well, there's... what are they?
A very Harold and Kumar Christmas.
A very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas.
Right. Well, that was a Christmas in 3D. I don't know.
No, it's a 3D Christmas. And?
Well, don't you want to talk about Harold and Kumar first?
Well, yeah, why not? This is, you know...
You liked the first one. We both liked the first one. I never saw the second one.
The second one I didn't hate, but it was diminishing returns time. We haven't had one for like 3 years, and they pretend it's been six. And, of course, we haven't had one partly because Cal Penn's been working for Obama during this time period.
And he killed himself.
Famously on a television show.
And, well, it's TV. You can always come back. Then apparently they're going to play it like Harold and Kumar have not had anything to do with each other, and they've kind of gone their separate ways. But a parcel gets delivered to the wrong one of them that's supposed to go to the other one, and I'm assuming the parcel contains drugs from the way it is written up. And so Kumar takes the parcel over to give to Harold, if that is indeed, I'm not sure about or who got the wrong parcel. In any case, the whole thing comes down to Harold's father-in-law's prize Christmas tree gets burned. And rather than deal with this, they set out on a quest, and by this time I'm pretty sure they're stoned, through New York City to find the perfect Christmas tree to replace the perfect Christmas tree. Thereby hangs the plot.
I think part of the issue, there's probably plenty of issues with this, but it's the beginning of November.
Yes, it's a little early for Christmas.
Yeah. I mean, last year there wasn't even a Christmas movie. I don't believe there was a Christmas movie last year, which is sort of idiotic because you put anything in theaters the day after Thanksgiving with Christmas in it.
Yes, but you can't really say that this one's not going to, you know. This is not going to, the families are not going to, I've seen the Red Band trailer, the families are not going to flock to this.
No. So.
Nor may, in fact, anyone else.
Right.
So there's that, and then there's another film, which I guess you're going to get Justin.
So Justin can talk about it.
Tower Heist.
A Brett Ratner film.
Yeah. I mean, the trailer looked good until you see.
A Brett Ratner film.
Yeah. I mean... And Eddie Murphy to a lesser extent.
Yeah.
And Matthew Broderick to
an even lesser extent, yeah.
It's one of these. What would you call this? I don't know.
I don't know.
High wattage, star power, sort of Ocean's 11.
Surprisingly.
It could be Brett Ratner's Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
That's what you're telling me.
Yeah.
One of the screenwriters is the guy who wrote Ocean's 11.
Oh, okay. Well. Too bad the director is Brett Ratner.
Yeah.
Who maybe he's settled down.
I find that hard to believe. What was his last movie? Rush Hour 3? Yeah, he settled down.
He's not making anything else.
He's been doing TV since that.
No.
That and after he killed the X-Men franchise, I think it was.
So, are you excited about seeing
Power Heist?
Yeah, come on.
No.
You wish you
Why would I be excited about a Ben Stiller movie that's not directed by Wes Anderson?
That's an excellent point, actually.
I'm not dreading it, though.
I mean, Zoolander.
A Ben Stiller movie that's not directed by Ben Stiller
or Wes Anderson.
Reality Bites excluded because Ethan Hawke is in it.